There are several things I'd like to do this afternoon. One is give you a little glimpse of the trip, but it's not just a trip report to be a trip report. I want to make some applications of it because both Carol and I feel that the Lord really spoke to our hearts in some significant ways as a result of this last trip. Now, we've been overseas before, almost in every country that the navigators are serving in, not quite all of them. But for some reason or other, the Lord used this particular trip in some significant ways in our own lives and continued to do some things and make some emphases in our hearts that He had started a number of months prior to the trip. Carol and I, on several occasions, have volunteered to go to the mission field with the navigators. There were a couple of real close ones. In fact, one time when we were still in Chicago, we had been asked to pray about going to Europe, and we were pretty excited about it. It wasn't something we really needed to even pray very long about, you know, 20 seconds or something like that. And we said, yes, we would be happy to go, and everything seemed to be coming together. We had raised some finances. Carol had even had a farewell party with some of the gals that she had been ministering with. And then at the last minute, the navigators changed their minds and we ended up staying in Chicago. We have learned since then not to get too excited about any move until you are actually in the car on the way there or an airplane. And even that isn't sure. I can remember one time we'd asked Charlie and Pam Green to make a move. I think it was from Purdue University up to Kalamazoo. No, it wasn't from Purdue to Kalamazoo. It was Bowling Green to Kalamazoo to take over the ministry at Western Michigan University. And there were several of us that were meeting about the same time that Charlie and Pam were on the road with a truck full of furniture heading toward Kalamazoo. And an emergency situation come up. There had been a change. Somebody had gotten sick or died or resigned or something. I can't remember what it was. And we desperately had to have Charlie and Pam in another place. And so we called Kalamazoo, the navigator-owned home there, got a hold of somebody, asked them if Charlie and Pam had arrived yet, and they said, yes, they just got in this morning. The truck is sitting outside. And I said, well, don't let them unpack it yet. And they got Charlie was someplace else. We finally got a hold of him. He called me in Chicago, and I said, here's the situation. We explained it to him. I apologized. And I said, we'd like to have you and Pam go to Purdue. And so they piled in the truck the next day and went to Purdue. So, you know, that's, I don't know whether we still do those types of things or not, but some of you are shaking your head yes and some no. But anyway, Carol and I have volunteered about a half a dozen times to go overseas. We have a real burden for it. We always have. In fact, when I first came on the staff, right after Doss Troutman had died, I attended my first staff conference right here in this room in July of 1956. And that was the first time I'd ever met Lauren Sanney. And he asked me what I had on my heart, and I said, well, we'd like to go to the Philippines. Well, we tried to get there, and that never worked out. So we're still here in the United States. But I really have always had a burden for missions and a heart for it. And since being in this job, I think I have seen more than ever before the tremendous opportunity that we have here in the United States of making a significant contribution to missions. Now, I have never had a romantic view of the mission field. I know some people do. They get this kind of gleam in their eye, and the mission field is sort of a glamorous, romantic type of thing. I've never really had that. And this last trip, if I had had any romantic visions of the mission field, this last trip would have completely dissolved all of them. Because where we went and what we saw and the things that we experienced made us realize more than ever before the price that our gang around the world pay to be missionaries. I want to tell you about three places that we were. I don't have time to go into detail on everything, but I just want to tell you about three things, three places that we were. The first difficult experience that we really had, as some of you know, Carol's sister, Joy, her younger sister, about a little over 2 years ago, had contracted leukemia, and for the past few months had been going downhill quite rapidly. Just before we left on the trip, Carol had spent 11 days back in Michigan with her, and that was a very heart-rending experience, sitting in the hospital room with Joy and just seeing her day by day deteriorate and the excruciating pain that she was experiencing. But she talked it over with Fred, Joy's husband, and with their two children, and they all agreed that Carol should go ahead and go on the trip because the doctors did not know how long Joy would last. It could be days, it could have been months, and so there was no way of telling. So we had prayed about it, they had prayed about it, and we felt that that was the right thing to do. We'd been out over in Europe about 10 days. We were leaving on a Tuesday morning from Stuttgart, Germany, to fly to Accra, Ghana, and at 5:30 a.m. in the morning, Lynn, our daughter, called us at Joe Bob's home, where we were staying with Joe and Sharon Bob, and told us that Joy had died on Memorial Day. Well, to describe the shock and the anguish that that was to Carol, of course, is impossible. And yet, in another way, as we look back on it, we see that God planned that trip in such a way as to give Carol time for God to do a healing work. And the whole rest of the trip, the first few days were very, very difficult for Carol. The memorial service for Joy was held on the following Saturday, and we had an all-day conference in Ghana that we spoke at on that Saturday. And that was a pretty hard day for Carol. But from that point on, it seemed like God just put his hand on her life and began to heal. And by the time we got home, her spirits were high, and God had really healed over the wound. So his timing was perfect in that aspect of the trip. We got to Ghana, and the second day we were there, Dave and Sherry Hall picked us up at our hotel at about 7:30 a.m., and we were going to take a trip with them over to the next country, Togo, to a town called Lomé. It's about a two-hour ride on roads the likes of which very few of us have ever been on here in the United States, especially a paved road. It had potholes in it. Dave is not the slowest driver in the world, and it was very interesting to watch him dodge the potholes. And then about eight times along the way, we were stopped by the military police, and the car was searched and looked into. The day before we left, Dave had spent the better part of the day getting visas for all of us to get out of Ghana, across the border into Togo, and then back out of Togo and back into Ghana. And it just takes time to do that. And so it probably took him three quarters of the day before just getting those visas for us so we could make this trip. Now, the reason we were going was to buy food. Ghana is an impoverished country. When they kicked the British out, lock, stock, and barrel, the Ghanese took over everything, the business, the government, and as a result of that, everything went downhill very rapidly, including the economy of the country. The food that you can buy is so expensive that it's almost prohibitive. But the problem is there isn't much of it around. They took us into what they referred to as a supermarket. if you were to walk into it and you knew that that was the name of it, you would laugh. It was a little dinky place about half the size of this room with shelf after shelf after shelf of three things: cooking oil, ketchup, and canned peas. And that's all you could buy, because that's all they had. And there was just shelf after shelf after shelf of those three products. Now, the following week, it might be three other things. And the week after that, if they got a shipment of some kind in. But the problem is, even to buy those products are so expensive that our gang don't feel right about doing it. A little can of peas, that high and about that big, around $2.50. It is impossible to get anything repaired in Ghana. You do not dare take your car into a garage because you will have fewer parts on it when you get it back than when you took it in, let alone getting something fixed. I mean, it won't be fixed. Everything is exorbitant in price. There is nothing new to buy. They cannot get new products. So every time our gang in Ghana want to buy something, they have to make a trip to Togo. It's 2 hours over, 2 hours back, a half an hour minimum each way going through the borders, plus anywhere from a half a day to a whole day, 2 or 3 days ahead of time, getting the visas to make the trip. Then when you get into Lomé, it's French-speaking. It's a French-speaking country. Everything you buy, you barter for. It's not, you know, price on the shelf type of thing, and you walk in and you pay your money. You walk in and they buy most of their things at the open market. There's a little stall for rice, a little stall for sugar, a little stall for flour, a little stall for meat, a little stall for dried beans or peas, and you stand there and you bargain with the people. In French, which none of our people speak, they kind of, you know, it's a combination of sign language, a few words of French, holding up fingers and writing down figures, and all of it is done with a smile on your face. It's not the hard-nosed type of bargaining that we would be used to here in the United States. It's all on a very friendly basis, and it's sort of a, you must humble yourself. Sherry Hall is the whiz kid of all bargainers, for my money, anywhere in the world. She is absolutely beautiful. I have never seen anything like it in my life. With her smile and her humility, she melts hearts all over the place. You know, you just follow her around. This sign right here is the sign for "I beg you." And wherever you go and you're bargaining for something, Carol can do it better than I can, but Sherry will say, "Oh, mon ami, I beg you, what is your very best price?" And then they start bargaining, you know. Well, I mean, you think about a shopping trip when you're buying for three families, three ITs, and a couple of other people for anywhere from a month to 6 weeks. Now, there were four of us in the car, and we came back with the car absolutely jammed full of food, plus a rack on top that was full. Ordinarily, when they make that trip, two guys go by themselves in two cars, and they come back with both cars loaded to the gills with food. They do have freezers, so they can freeze some of the stuff. In order to bring the meat back, they take these little, what we would take on a picnic, a camping trip, you know, just a box with ice in it. And they bring the meat back on that 2.5 to 3 hour trip, and then they freeze it. But that day was an experience, the likes of which we shall never forget. And Carol's reaction, of course, just the sights and the sounds and the smells, for instance, when you're walking around inside of this open market, you do not dare look down at the floor. You would throw up if you did, because of what you're walking on and what you see. And yet that's where you're buying your food. The women, as well as most of the men, carry everything on their heads. I saw a woman walking down the street in front of the hotel where we were staying with a sewing machine on the top of her head. At the market there, I saw another gal with with boxes of canned goods. The boxes were about that big a square and about that high. And she had five of those stacked on top of one another on her head, walking around just like this, you know, nothing to it. And there they were, way up on top of her. We did hear that they have a few back problems later on in life. But the sights are indescribable. Even, you know, full-color living stereo wouldn't do it justice. You've just got to see it to believe it. My reaction and Carol's reaction to this whole thing was completely different. I wanted to cry simply because of I realized this was how our gang have to live. This is real life to them. This is no game. This is not something they do just once in a while. This is the way they have to survive. Carol was so fascinated with what was going on around her and the sights, and she was sitting in the car there just outside the market in Lomé and waiting for the rest of us, and these little kids would come up and just stare. I mean, you are really in the minority there. You're a white person among everybody that's black. And many of those kids have never seen a white person. And so they would just stand outside the car and stare at Carol. Not for 30 seconds, but for 15 minutes. And never blink an eye, just stand there and stare at her. So she was quite fascinated by that. If they want to buy a new washing machine, they have to go to Lomé. If they want to buy a new car, they have to go to Lomé. If they want to get repairs done, they have to go to Lomé. If they want to get a part for something, they have to go to Lomé. It's a two-hour drive over, plus the border crossing, plus getting the visas ahead of time, plus the trip back. To buy a car requires a minimum of three trips over and back. First of all, to go over and pick out the car. Then once it's there, to go over and check it out and get all the paperwork done. And then the third trip to go over and pick it up and bring it back. And that's minimum. Sometimes there's a couple more things involved, depending on how complicated it may get. Our guys are really ingenious in the way that they have figured out how to help themselves financially. They have felt and prayed over the fact that the black market is not the route that they should go in exchanging money. I can't remember the exact figures, but when I was there, the official exchange rate was about 3 or 4 CDs to the dollar. But on the black market, you could get somewhere around 9 or 10. And so it would make quite a difference. But our guys have decided they will not go the black market route. They will go the official exchange rate. But the interesting thing is that everybody wants dollars. And so what they will do is they, for instance, on a car, they'll buy a car in Lomé for American dollars, and they want American dollars so much that our guys can go over there, write out a check on a Colorado Springs bank for $4,000 or $5,000 to buy a car, and they'll take it, no questions asked. Then they drive the car for 2 or 3 years, and little things begin to go wrong with it. It begins to break down, and of course they can fix some things themselves. But finally, when it gets to the point where it's just causing them too much trouble, they will sell it in Lomé for far more in CDs than they paid for it in dollars. And they add that to their monthly budget, and it really is an asset to them. They've got it figured out financially how they can come out ahead on many, many things like that. Same thing on a washing machine or a freezer or a refrigerator, motorcycle. So that was our introduction to what it takes to live as a missionary in Ghana. Now, before I went, there had been a request by Marv Smith and the guys from Ghana for an administrative assistant to help out in the country. Well, as you know, we don't think administrative assistants ought to be that numerous around the United States. We discourage state directors from having them. We know they're important for the RDs. John, we love you. But we had a hard time figuring out why would three couples and three ITs ministering in a country need a full-time administrative assistant? Well, I came out of Ghana feeling they not only needed a full-time administrative assistant, but he needed an assistant to help him in order to lift the load off of the missionaries so they could do missionary work, because they spend over half their time just living. And if they had a good, sharp guy out there who could make all those trips to Lomé, that in itself would save days and days and days of time, a year. So we've got a guy on his way now, and he's coming from the Northeast region. Bob Lewis has found a guy who can meet the requirements, and I want to talk to Bob next week about the possibility of sending an IT with him to assist him, because he will need help. I think that's one of the things that I learned from the trip, is that there are many places, and I'm sure that Ghana is not the only one, where we have a hard time from this side of the ocean understanding some of their requests and why they want certain kinds of people and why things are needed just the way they describe them. And it's impossible for us to understand that until we get over there and are actually in the situation, see it, and experience it for ourselves. And this is one of the reasons why I've asked the RDs to take at least a trip overseas once every other year. And in fact, if they can do it every year, that would be preferable. So that when we sit down around the table at the RD meetings and discuss these personnel requirements, somebody has been there recently and can interact with us and let us know what the need really is and why the guys are requesting this kind of a person. Another interesting little tidbit on Ghana was shortly after Bruce and Donna Carlson and their two children had moved into a new home, the one that Marv Smith has been living in. One day, their oldest daughter was playing out in the front yard, and she came running to Bruce, who was in the house, and said, "Daddy, there's a red snake out in the front yard." Well, Bruce had never heard of a red snake, didn't even know that such a thing existed. And so he says, "Well, show me." And so he went out into the front yard, and she pointed to it, and it was over under some bushes, and it wasn't red at all, it was gray. It blended in very well with the foliage and the grass. It was a spitting cobra. Now, they got a couple of people together and got some clubs and they killed it. One of the things that Bruce happened to know is that spitting cobras mate for life. And so where you find one, there's usually a second one around someplace. And so he let all the neighbors know. And they kept a watch out, and sure enough, about 3 weeks later, they spotted the second one and killed it. Now, why did his little girl see a red snake? Well, the only conclusion that Bruce and Donna can come to is God's hand of protection, because the snake was very difficult to see. It blended in so well, and had she gotten close, it rears up and it spits, and it's very accurate, right of the eyes, and it can blind a person unless they're treated very quickly. And the only conclusion they can come to is that God turned that snake red, or at least she saw it red so that she saw it. That was in the front yard. The mission field is not romantic. I don't believe it's romantic. Craig Goldfain is one of our ITs there, and doing an outstanding job, has really gotten a grasp of, actually English is the official language in Ghana. They speak it with quite an accent, but the tribal language is called Twi, and Craig has really learned Twi. He's working on it, and the Ghanaians are a very loving, warm, open-hearted type of people. It's not hard to love them at all. In fact, we fell in love with them in just 5 days. And whenever you speak any word of Twi to them, why, they just beam, you know, that even if it's only two or three words. Well, Craig has really won the hearts of a number of the students there at the university in Accra. And just recently, he had a bout with hepatitis that almost took his life. He had taken a trip last Easter with one of his key men up to his home back in the woods, had stayed over the weekend with them, eaten their food, slept in their beds, drank their water, etc. And the incubation period is such that he came down with hepatitis just after we were there, and that was about, so that's what they've figured, that weekend trip up to one of his key men's home to stay with his family was the time, and it almost killed him. It's going to be another 6 months or so before he's really back on top. We went to Egypt. We were in Egypt for 5 days. Now, Ghana has some beauty to it, although it's hot and humid, and without air conditioning, white people have a very difficult time making it. The British, even though they controlled and colonialized Ghana, never really enjoyed living there. It was the white man's graveyard before we had things that protected you against yellow fever and malaria and things of that nature, shots that you could take. And in fact, the guys were telling me when I was there that in the early days of missions in Ghana, many of the mission boards would require that the missionaries come with some of their goods packed in their coffin because they knew they'd never get out of the country. And so they had their coffin already. Rather morbid, but rather realistic. There is some beauty. There's beautiful flowers and trees and shrubs in Ghana. In Egypt, there is nothing that is beautiful. Absolutely nothing. Everything is stark, dry, dirty, and unattractive. It's a bleak country. It's a hard country. The Arabic language in and of itself is so difficult to learn. The Muslim influence with the minarets and their loudspeakers screaming on and off all day long and all night. Bud Van Est, when we were lining up this trip, wrote me and he said, be sure and bring some earplugs with you. And I couldn't figure that out until we got there. Everybody honks their horn in Egypt, whether they need to or not. It's just simply to let you know that they are there. And yesterday I loaned Nabil Jabour our car, and it was apparently the first time he has ever driven an automatic transmission. And he was quite concerned about making sure that he knew how to do that. He says, the one thing that frightens me here in America is coming down a street and seeing somebody come out of a side street. I don't know whether they're really going to stop or not, because they never do in Egypt. You just take that into consideration. The lines down the street mean absolutely nothing. One-way streets mean nothing. It's every man for himself. Traffic lights, it doesn't make any difference whether it's red or green. That really doesn't have anything to do with it. It's just if it's clear. Nabil and Trudy Crawford picked Carol and I up at the airport, and we had been, I don't want to get into too much detail, but some little things are rather interesting. We had been told by several people that when you go into Egypt, it is really a hassle getting through the airport. It's mobbed and jammed, and you got to walk over people, and you can't get through everything until you trade some American money for Egyptian currency. And so we got there expecting all kinds of hassle, and nothing happened. I mean, it was just like a breeze. And Carol kept telling me, honey, don't you think we ought to get some money exchange? We saw some money changers here. And I said, no, I'm not going to do it until they tell me I have to. So we just kept going through one stage after another. And finally got all the way through everything, and we had our luggage, and we're outside. Still, nobody had told us that we had to exchange money. Later on, we found out that because we had a visa ahead of time and had not gotten it in Egypt, which you can do, you can get it right there at the airport, therefore they do not require you to exchange money in order to get in the country. However, we did find out that we could get ITs and missionary associates into Egypt very easily, and they don't even have to have a visa. All they have to do is show up at the airport with $150, exchange it for Egyptian currency, and that gives them 2 months in the country. And 2 months later, they come back with another $150 and change it at the airport, and they get 2 more months. Pretty simple system. So it opens the doors for some things that we might want to do in the future. At least that's the way it is now. They took us out to the car, finally got our stuff in the trunk, and then Nabil took the key and unlocked the door, as any of us would normally do at an airport. We would lock our car. Then we climbed in, and he unrolled the shade across the windshield and the back window. There's a just like a shade on a window, you know, you pull it down, then you let it go, and it'll roll up. Well, he has one like that across the front and across the back, and it's to keep the sun from baking the inside of the car. It is warm in Egypt. Then he took another key and unlocked a little gizmo that was a steel rod with a hook on each end, one attached to the steering wheel, one hook attached to the steering wheel, and one hook attached to the clutch pedal, and with a lock in the middle of it. He unlocked that and put it under the seat. Then he reached over and flipped under the dashboard a little, very insignificant switch, and then he turned on the ignition. I said, why go to all that trouble? He says, well, people will steal my car if I don't. You know, things are bad in America. But every time he gets out of his car, that's what he goes through, regardless of where he is. And he's of course, very efficient at it now. He can do that so quick you'd never even notice it. But very interesting. And then the drive from the airport to Trudy's apartment was an experience with Nabil. He, you know, one-way streets mean absolutely nothing. We were going down a couple of them the wrong way. Red lights, we went through them. We were driving on the wrong side of the street half the time. It was wild. There is, in fact, he had to take me over to pick up my other car yesterday, and he says, you know, the thing that is so amazing here in America is how orderly everything is when you drive. Well, I could make a similar comment about Egypt, but it'd be just the opposite. But Trudy Crawford, bless her heart, man, she is so at home there. She loves Cairo, 14 million people or something like that. It's hot, it's dirty, and yet she loves it, and she loves those people. And God has really opened up some doors of opportunity for us in a very difficult Muslim country. Nabil and I, for instance, spent a whole morning with this Father Zachariah. Some of you have heard or read about him. A man who is on the verge of being excommunicated from the Coptic Church, a very evangelical man and a very outstanding preacher. And he has been forbidden to preach. Before this all happened, a little over a year ago, he was having regular meetings one night a week in his church where there were 3,000 and 4,000 people attending. And there were at least 40 or 50 people each night being saved. Well, now he can't preach, but he has a little team of men that he is working through, 8 of them. He meets with them individually every week, builds into their lives. They all have individual ministries with other men, little teams of their own. And his ministry is growing to the place where it's almost as large now by working through 8 men as it was he had before from the platform. And he is so turned on and so excited about man-to-man. That's what we spent the whole morning talking about. And this guy is a very prominent man in Egypt, well known and very highly respected. We took the train up to Alexandria. Almost everywhere we went, we had a plan B, just in case somebody didn't show up at an airport to meet us and what we should do, or had a phone number, or somebody to call, or directions how to get a taxi from the airport to someplace. And as Carol and I got on the train and sat down, we realized that we did not have a plan B. that if Bud and Joyce Van Ness did not meet us at the train station in Alexandria, we had no address, we had no phone number, we didn't know where they lived, we didn't know what to do. And we panicked for about 2 minutes, and then we prayed about it, and sure enough, Bud and Joyce were there to meet us. And after we got to their apartment and had gone to bed that night, we realized why he had told us to bring earplugs. Their apartment is right on the main street in Alexandria, and as I said, they honk horns all the time, and that goes on most of the night. Plus the minarets with their loudspeakers broadcasting the prayers every 4 or 5 hours. And so we were very grateful that we had picked up some earplugs in Germany and brought them with us, and they really worked. We went shopping with Bud and Joyce, and there is no way I could describe that. Joyce told us that after they first moved up there, and the first 3 or 4 times she went shopping, and it's the only place to shop is with the open market, that she ended up in tears. She would just break down and cry. They are not, in Egypt, they are not like the people in Ghana. They bargain, they barter, but it's with barbs. It's sarcastic. It's hard. And they're harsh, and they'll cheat you if they can. And so Joyce just broke down and cried. But she's gotten over that, and God has given her grace and victory in it. And she does it now with the best of them. Romania. We got to go into 2 countries behind the Iron Curtain, Romania and Yugoslavia. We got into Bucharest on the plane, went through 3 different searches before we got even to our luggage. And then they went through that, armed guards standing around with machine guns pointing at you most of the time. And then Steve and Marie Ramey met us with their little girl. And drove us around Bucharest and showed us a little of the sights in the city, took us to a hotel where we were all staying that night, and gave us a little briefing in the car to be very careful of what you say anywhere in public where there are other people around. Don't say anything significant in your hotel room because it's probably bugged. For sure, do not accept any kind of exchange that would be black market, because they can put you in jail for that, and they deliberately do it with Americans just to tempt you. That was Saturday, and then Sunday we were to spend all day with a group of key couples in Romania, 6 couples who are scattered all over the country and who we have been ministering to and with over the last several years. They're all people who are really with us in heart. They are sold out to the Great Commission. They want to see disciples raised up in Romania, and they all have their own ministries wherever they are. A doctor, a mathematician, a couple of school teachers. And so we got up about 6 o'clock the next morning. I had breakfast and then headed for a little apartment where we were to meet the rest of these couples. And on the way, Steve briefed us on what the day would be like and what we should expect, what we should do and what we should not do. And also, we devised a cover story that in case the secret police should show up, we would all be in agreement on why we were there. The cover story was that Steve and I had met one another in the United States at a conference in Green Lake in 1970, which was true. And that we happened to run into one another at the airport in Bucharest, which also was true, almost. And that he knew that we had written a book on the subject of marriage, and he and Marie happened to be in Bucharest, and they knew another couple in Bucharest who were very much interested in the whole subject of marriage as it related to Romanians, and they were doing quite a bit of thinking about it and interacting with other couples on it, and so he wanted us to meet this couple, and so he took us over to their apartment, and lo and behold, They had some other friends in, all of whom were interested in this subject of marriage, and so we spent the day together. Good night. Fortunately, nothing happened. Carol and I felt like we were playing games, you know, hide and seek, cops and robbers, that type of thing. But it was real. It was very real. Just 2 weeks prior to that, one of the key people of one of these couples, who had been quite outspoken with regards to his testimony, had been almost run down by the secret police with a car. They tried to kill him. We got near the apartment, and Steve dropped Carol and Marie and the baby off, and they were to make their way through some circuitous route to the apartment, the three of them together. Then we drove around a couple of more blocks, parked the car, and came in together from another way. And so everybody gradually showed up, ones and twos, over a period of time. And by about 9 o'clock, everyone was there. In a little small apartment, the room in which we met, you know, was kind of like the alcove over there with maybe 10 more feet this way. It was one of the hottest days they'd had in Bucharest in weeks, I guess. We had to close the windows. They checked the phone. They unscrewed both ends of the phone, checked it, make sure it wasn't bugged. And then one of the guys says, well, just to make sure, let's put it out in the hall, which they did on the other side of a door. You know, that's a different way of life than I'm used to, that we're used to. We started in about 9 o'clock, went till about 12:30, broke for about an hour for lunch, had lunch right there in the apartment. Now, when I say apartment, gang, there is nobody in all of the Pacific region who lives in the kind of housing, even close to the kind of housing that that apartment was. We would refer to it as slums. You had to go through the kitchen to get to the bathroom. You wives would feel put upon if you had to live with a kitchen like that. No hot water, an old beat up dirty sink, a little dinky stove, cramped, just unbelievable. And yet, Mihai was the name of the man in whose apartment we were, he and his wife, and his mother and his sister came over and cooked the meal for us. And they spent all morning, while we were meeting, they were out in the kitchen preparing that meal for about 18 of us. And it was greatly appreciated. It was a wonderful meal. Then we went until 7 o'clock that night, and by then Carol and I were pretty well exhausted, and they wanted to keep going, so we answered a few more questions and went home and died in our hot hotel room. No air conditioning. That's a day we'll never forget. Steve would like to have us come back and do that same type of thing in three different cities in Romania on three successive weekends with couples. Well, in one way, we'd love to do it. But in another way, you know, we wonder, are we really willing to pay that kind of a price? Boy, that's hard. But that's what it takes to be a missionary in Eastern Europe. We were in Vienna, of course, for about 5 days with a gang there. And, of course, most of our people live in Vienna. Some of the ITs live right in the country. Two of the ITs that were at this meeting, one of them lives right in Romania, has learned the language, feels at home, wanders around all over the country. Fantastic. Just absolutely fantastic. Everywhere we went, the IT program, nobody could say enough for it. It's probably, without a doubt, the most successful attempt at any missionary endeavor that the Navigators have tried. Now, that I'm not taking away from anything else we've done, but God really has His hand on that in a very unique and wonderful way. The guys, of course, who are working in Eastern Europe, when they leave home from Vienna and they go in, what they call inside, for usually at least 2 weeks, and their wives know their schedules. We talked to a couple of the wives that when they first came over, they admitted they were scared to death. They were fearful all day long. They were fearful of their husbands leaving and never coming back. But God has overcome all of that. They have perfect peace. They have real tranquility of spirit. God's grace is undertaken in every one of their hearts. And that most of them have an arrangement that if they're 2 days late, that their wives should contact the American embassy. So far, that has not had to happen. We were supposed to go into Poland. We had visas for Poland, and our plan was to fly into Warsaw and then meet Case and Astra de Jong in there and spend 2 or 3 days with them. But while we were still on the trip and before we got to Vienna, they had changed our plans and had arranged for us to drive into Poland, which meant going across Czechoslovakia. And so when we got into Vienna, they went down to the embassy and made arrangements to get us visas to go across Czechoslovakia. But because of a little technicality and a foul-up, we got to the border, and they wouldn't let us in. Now, I wish I could describe to you that experience. But you talk about scary, brother. You drive up to the border, and it's a great, big, huge barrier that swings on a pivot, and it would stop a tank trying to get through it. It's got a great big chunk of concrete as big as this pulpit hanging on the end of it. And it takes 2 men to just to push the thing and get it open. And you drive through that, and then they close it. And you're inside Czechoslovakia at the border crossing. Nobody spoke English, so Case had to do all the dealings in German. And because of this little foul-up on our visas, well, he went from this guy to this guy, and he finally ended up talking to 5 different people, and each of them kept getting mad. Case did a beautiful job. He did not lose his cool. He did not get angry, but he was persistent. And finally, the last guy that he talked to, who apparently was the chief honcho, the problem was nobody wanted to make a decision that they might get in trouble for later. And they could have cared less about us. And we tried to explain to them all we did want to do was drive across their country. I want to say dumb country, but country. And finally, this one, after about 45 minutes of this, the last guy that Case talked to really got angry, walked us out to the car, and gave us 5 minutes to get out. Now, there are guys standing around all over the place with machine guns. And so when he said 5 minutes to get out, we believed him. And so we got in the car and left. And we didn't get to Poland. It's just a totally different world. It's unreal. But that's what our gang face every time they go across the border, because most of the time they drive. God is at work in Eastern Europe. When we first started the ministry in Eastern Europe, there were a number of us who had real reservations about it, and I was among them. I'll admit that. But Doug Sparks was so insistent and so convinced that God was in this that he kept persisting. In fact, he got obnoxious about it at times. But bless his heart, he knew that God was in this, and he convinced us, and of course we put Paul Stanley over there, and he was just the right man to get that thing off the ground. But then, even then, we were reluctant to apply too many resources because we weren't really going to get anything out of it, as far as we could tell. I mean, it was what we at sometime or other would refer to as a non-productive ministry. By non-productive, we meant it wasn't going to benefit the navigators in any way. We weren't going to get any staff out of it, or maybe not even any DMs. Certainly no basic workforce. You know, in the normal way that we count or evaluate a ministry, there was no way we could do that. Well, you know, you can't outgive God. He will be no man's debtor. We now have people inside of a half a dozen of those Eastern European countries who are going to be navigator staff, who God is going to give us. Just in the next 3 to 5 years, they are almost ready. And they're going to stay inside. They're nationals. They know the language. They know the culture. They know the ropes. They know how to endure and exist and live inside and have a ministry. This isn't being taped, is it? Well, whatever is being taped should just be erased the last 15 or 20 minutes. Paul Stanley, when we were in Vienna, had just gotten back from a trip to Russia. He had met with 5 or 6 of the key evangelical leaders in Russia for 2 days to talk to them about the possibility of publishing the Navigator Bible Studies in Russian and having them distributed and used among evangelical groups, and to also give them help in the use of the materials to really make sure that they would produce disciples and disciple makers. Well, to make a long story short, this, of course, was all through an interpreter. They bought Paul's proposal, lock, stock, and barrel. They are eager to have the materials. They are eager to have help in how to use the materials. And then the issue came up of how can we get them printed? And one of the top leaders kind of smiled and said, oh, that's no problem. But we can get them printed. So they went on to describe the fact that they have 5 printing presses scattered throughout Russia that are completely portable and that produce the best quality printing and typeface anywhere in Russia. Now, some genius who is a Christian figured out how to build this printing press. Then he built another one, then he built another one, and there are 5 of them now. There were 6, and the KGB found one and were quite jubilant over it because they knew that this stuff was being printed. And thought that they had, you know, the whole thing closed down. And they're now in the process of building another one, a 6th one. They're completely portable. They can move them on just, you know, a couple hours' notice. And the typeface is the most beautiful typeface in all of Russia, because what they did was they took the best Moscow newspaper, which has a beautiful typeface, and letter by letter, they cut it out and reproduced it on a... they photographed it and then put it on a plate and then put it in typeface. And so they now have the whole Moscow newspaper type to use for Christian publications. And the KGB thought that they had actually stolen the printing press from this newspaper in Moscow. But they didn't steal the printing press, they just duplicated the typeface. So the printing of this is no problem. It's just a matter now of getting the thing in gear and getting it translated, and then they'll get it printed. Eventually, however, we're going to want people to go into Russia. We need more people in Eastern Europe. We need more people in the Middle East. Africa is wide open to us. There's a passage in Scripture Isaiah 43, which the Lord gave to Doss as a promise many, many years ago. Lauren Sanney one day decided that he wanted some promises of his own from God and deliberately stayed away from the book of Isaiah because God had given Doss so many from Isaiah that he wanted something from a different book. But eventually God brought him back to the same passage and gave him these same verses as a promise of what God was going to do through the Navigator ministry. Isaiah 53, beginning with verse 4. Since you are precious and honored in my sight, and because I love you, I will give men in exchange for you, and people in exchange for your life. Do not be afraid, for I am with you. I will bring your children from the east and gather them from the west. I will say to the north, give them up, and to the south, do not hold back. Bring my sons from afar and my daughters from the ends of the earth. Everyone who is called by my name, whom I created for my glory, whom I formed and made. And gang, there are 4.5 billion people almost in the world today. And I believe that God, in the next few years, wants to use the United States in an unusual way to do the very thing that he's talking about here in Isaiah 53, 4 through 7. That he will give men in exchange for you and people in exchange for your life. But we are going to have to give people up. From the north, from the south, from the east, and yeah, from the Pacific region, the west. And send them to the uttermost parts of the earth. Now, what God has done through the navigators in the U.S. over the last number of years is really phenomenal. It's nothing to be ashamed of. It's something to praise God for. Right now, currently, Donald probably has the exact figure, but there are probably pretty close to 140 Americans, give or take a few, overseas. Reps, ITs, support personnel, and even a few missionary associates now. Many have gone and come back home and are still serving in a very significant way back home. They've made a contribution overseas. However, there are some things that I feel we can do a better job at. I feel we can step up our missionary program with an increasing tempo in the next few years without really hurting ourselves here at home, if we do it in the right way. For instance, I don't want to throw any statistics at you, but there's some things that I particularly keep my eye on with regards to missions. There are two things. One is the ratio of U.S. reps, American reps that are operating here at home in the field ministries, and American reps that are overseas, and the ratio of those two. And this past year, that ratio was 36% to 64%. In other words, not counting headquarters, not counting the people who are here, American reps who are working here at headquarters, but just who are working in the field ministries, both here in the United States and overseas somewhere, 64% of them are here in the U.S., 36% overseas. Now, I'd like to see those two figures gradually come closer together, which will indicate that we're getting more people overseas. In terms of gift income, the same thing. Last year, the proportion was 69% gift income spent here at home and 31% spent overseas. Now, The thing that probably concerns me more about that than anything else is the trend. It's not what just happened last year, but it's what's happened the last 3 to 4 years. And the trend is that it isn't changing all that much. There's a slight change for the better. By the better, I mean the percentage is going up slightly on the overseas side of the scale. But I would like to see us do more than we are now doing. Another factor that is involved in the same thing, that right now, for 1979 and 80, we have some 20 approved representative slots that are left unfilled. Now, there are some very good reasons for some of those being unfilled. But nevertheless, there are 20 for 1979 and 80. There are 40 IT slots for those same 2 years that are still unfilled. And I really feel that we need to give some more serious thought to getting more ITs overseas. Our Missionary Associates program is just getting underway, and it's very, very encouraging. It seems to be gaining momentum. We've just made a decision that I think is going to help us, and that is that we feel that we can help some of these people get overseas into a job that probably does not really pay enough to live on overseas, but if they could raise $300-$400 a month support in addition to that, it would help them. And we've made arrangements now that we can receipt that money, and thus I think it's going to kind of unclog the logjam on about 10 to 12 people that we've got ready to go. They've got a line on a job, but the job doesn't pay enough for them to live on over there. There are other opportunities, not only within the Navigators, but outside the framework of the Navigators. And I came back from this trip deeply concerned that we intensify our efforts to serve other organizations wherever we can and in whatever way we can. Let me tell you about two or three things that I ran into on this last trip. Right after we were in Ghana, Bob Sparks had taken a 3 or 4 week trip overseas and was in Ghana, and then he went up to Liberia to visit a fellow that he had known a number of years ago by the name of Gus Marwick. Gus is a Liberian. He was raised in a little back village, finally got out of the village, got an education, somehow came to the United States, got some more education, went back to Liberia, worked his way up through the system, and is now in charge of a training school for the training of civil servants for the government of Liberia. He's an outstanding Christian. He has disciple-making on his heart. He wants to incorporate disciple-making and Christianity into the whole program. He's got a free hand to do it from the government, and he wants a navigator to help him do that, to teach classes and to disciple men. And there is no problem with this. No problem in getting in the country. He'll work on the visa. All we've got to do is supply him with the man. That's tomorrow. Several months ago, last spring, I got a letter from a man by the name of John Ocker. John is the assistant to the director of the Sudan Interior Mission in Niger, which is a French-speaking country in North Africa. They have 150 missionaries in Niger. He and his boss, Gordon Bishop, a year or so ago, read the book DOS, and it absolutely revolutionized their thinking regarding the ministry. In fact, it turned them around 180 degrees. Gordon Bishop has been in touch with Jim Downing. John Ocker wrote me, and he was here at the Glen last May for the Black Conference that we had, and had time with several of us. And he wants the navigators to come into Niger and help them develop a disciple-making program with 150 missionaries. When I was in Nairobi, we had lunch with a young couple called Rod and Jan Wetzel. Rod and Jan were involved in the NAV ministry years ago at the University of Illinois. He wanted to come on the Navigator staff. We didn't feel he had the gifts or the qualifications. So we, you know, encouraged him along another route. He ended up out in Kenya with the Africa Inland Mission, and he and Jan have been there now for a couple of years. He has won the favor of the leadership of the Africa Inland Mission in Kenya to the point where now they have asked him to set up and teach a series of seminars all over Kenya with the pastors who are the product of the Africa Inland Mission, which is now called the Africa Inland Church. It's a denomination. And so now Rod is going around the country teaching these seminars. What Rod is doing has so impressed his boss that he has told Rod that if the Navigators will give AIM 7 men, he will plant one of them in each country in which AIM operates in Africa in order to do this same type of thing. At the Africa Staff Conference, which was just held recently in Nairobi, first time they've ever done that, about 40 people there, a number of people who are very closely working with the Navigators, not staff, people like Keith and Carol Plate, who've been out in Nigeria for years and have a Navigator ministry, but he's a doctor. And there was another couple there, a guy and his wife by the name of Alan Stickney. He's a Southern Baptist, has been a very close friend of Bruce Van Wyk for a number of years, is making disciples, and is so close to us that we invited him to come to our staff conference. Alan Stickney would like to leave the Southern Baptist denomination and come on the NAV staff. We would love to have him. He's a good man. But we feel he could be far more influential if he stayed with the Southern Baptist. And now he has been asked to speak at an all-Africa Southern Baptist convention to be held in Togo next March. He's the main speaker. And the topic is disciple making. Now, I could go on. These are just a few of the opportunities that God is giving us all over the world. And gang, I really feel that we are going to have to be willing to give up some good people in order to capitalize on and take advantage of some of these situations that are outside the realm of normal Navigator ministries and channels. But I think we've got enough examples down through history that whenever we've done this, God has always paid us back far more than we have ever given. I think the example in Eastern Europe and what is happening there is just one good example of that. Now, I think the question I keep asking myself, and you know, I'd like every Navigator staff person in the United States to ask themselves, what does God want us to do in missions? What part does He want us to have in missions in the next few years? Matthew 28, 18, 19, and 20. All nations. It says all nations. And gang, God has so blessed the United States, not only the Navigators, but just the United States in terms of resources and manpower and money and wealth and technology, that I feel that we need to seriously consider. Are we doing enough? What more can we do? You know, are you willing to go? Are you willing to raise up others to go? Are you willing to raise money to send others to go? Are you willing to pray for laborers to go in the light of Matthew 9, 37, 38? I want to close now, but there are two passages that God has been very heavily laying on my heart I can't remember whether I came, whether they began to burden me before I left on the trip or just after we left or what, but they're Philippians 2, 3, and 4 and Proverbs 11, 24, and 25. Philippians 2, 3, and 4. Let nothing be done through strife or vainglory, but in lowliness of mind let each esteem other better than themselves. Look not every man on his own things, but every man also on the things of others. You know, I look back and I can pinpoint certain instances when I have been outright obnoxious about providing people for missions from my region, from my division, and you know, it's one thing to be realistic and sensible and logical. It's another thing to be obnoxious. And I've sensed that in the past sometimes I've been obnoxious. Well, I hope God kicks me in the head or the rear end or something whenever that attitude begins to crop up again. But look not every man on his own things, but every man also on the things of others. Are we really considering enough? What are the needs of the world? And then Proverbs 11, 24 and 25. There is that scattereth, and yet increaseth. Now that is not logical. There is that scattereth and yet increaseth. There is that withholdeth more than is meat, but it tendeth to poverty. The liberal soul shall be made fat, and he that watereth shall be watered also himself. And what I would like to see happen in the United States is that kind of an attitude develop in all of our hearts toward missions. Not that we want to go off half-cocked and say, you know, the world is coming to an end and we got to do something now and get panicky about it. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about an attitude of giving. An attitude that is willing to sacrifice a little bit here to accomplish a great deal over there. In terms of men, women, and money. And advice, know-how, whatever is needed at this RD conference that we had in Germany with the MRDs and the USRDs. We talked about a lot of different things that could be done, short-term type things, and we're considering some of these. But the attitude expressed in these passages, if taken seriously by each of us, could change our own commitment toward missions from passive to active, and it could dramatically affect our national strategy within the United States. How could it affect our strategy within the United States? Well, Jerry's been meeting with the Community Advisory Committee. And one of the things that we talked about yesterday morning was what contribution can the community ministry make to missions? Well, I think a great deal. We haven't thought a great deal about that. But some of the most experienced and mature men that we have are now in the community ministry. And in certain places of the world, that's the very kind of man that we need. But sometimes our attitude is, well, we can't spare him because of the ministry he's got. Well, gang, I think we're going to have to figure out in some cases how we can spare him in order to get the job done overseas, because he's the very resource that's needed over there. I think of the collegiate ministry. I think something that could dramatically affect our strategy for the collegiate ministry is a commitment to missions. How much is the collegiate ministry going to expand in the United States? How much should we let it expand? How many college campuses should we be on? Should we have in our mind every college campus in the United States? Small, big, little, commuter, non-commuter? Well, maybe not. Maybe we ought to think in terms of limiting ourselves to certain strategic campuses across the United States, just enough in order to keep us producing the kind of product that we need to meet our own needs internally and ascend and ascend and ascend. And not keep expanding geographically here in the U.S. until such time as God, you know, pulls the string on missions. These are just a few thoughts that are going through my mind, but you can obviously tell that I'm really excited about what I feel God wants us to do in the future in terms of getting as many people overseas as we can. I really want to see us get more of our DMs overseas, people who are not going to be staff, but who have all that good background of NAV training. They know how to win people to Christ. They know how to follow up on new Christians. They know how to make disciples. They've got maturity and savvy. And they would be a tremendous asset to some missionary out there in Africa or in the Philippines or in Indonesia. Not necessarily a navigator missionary. Well, these are some few things to think about. I've gone much longer than I wanted to. John, I'm perfectly willing to stay here and answer questions if you'd like to do that. I'll turn it back to you and then you decide.
Let me just ask you a minute, of course. I'll stand up a minute. If you have a question too, go ahead.
Rick? Yeah, Jack, how do you see this week of prayer that's coming up? How do you see that getting the grassroots ministries getting their vision on the world, on what we're doing in the world, on the whole missionary effort? Seems that would be a really good opportunity to do that.
Yeah. Well, all the country leaders were asked to turn in 5 requests for that. And so 2 of the things that I put down as things to pray about was, first of all, that God would show us what He wanted us to do in a greater expansion of our missionary program from the United States, and that He would very definitely lead us to do this, and not only in terms of the people, but the money. See, we financially seem to be constantly operating right at the edge of disaster. But I feel in order to really do something significant in missions, we are going to have to figure out new ways to get money from people who are interested. We're going to have to be more committed to that. We're going to have to be willing to sacrifice for it. That's why I put in there, are we willing to go? Are we willing to raise up people to go? Are we willing to raise money to let other people go? And see, that's what it's going to take from all of us. So that's one of the requests I have on there. The other one is this human resources department, for lack of a better term, that's what we're calling it now. But basically, I think that's really going to help us in our missionary program and just enabling us to get a better handle on what people are available, what kind of people should go to the mission field, how we can do a better job at selection. And so we're just getting started in that this fall. So from my standpoint, that's 2 things that I feel that we could really pray about that would, you know, if God would answer, it would make a giant steps down the road.
Will some of that information be coming down to us through RSV so that as our people come along, that we can work with our state director in qualifying those people and encouraging them to pick up in certain classes that would be a benefit to them in an overseas situation?
Yeah, that's part of the thing that we want this human resources department to do, is to distribute and keep available more information on what could be done, what are the options, what are possibilities overseas, this type of thing. Yeah.
I was wondering if there was a program for an individual to get ready for Russia with the navigators now.
I don't think we have a program that is in operation. But if you have it on your heart, I certainly would encourage you to pray about it, because it is something we're going to be doing. I don't know how we're going to get them in, but Paul Stanley is figuring that out.
Jack, yeah. Can three items be sent through the mail to Donna?
Can they?
Yes.
Food items? Oh, they can be, but they'd probably never get to the people. And duty would also be a factor.
Genius Bible Study Group sent a large food parcel to the gang in Ghana for Sherry Wall.
CMA, we sent a CMA, it would take 7 months.
Yeah.
But they got it.
Did they?
That would always happen.
Yes, things that like Kool-Aid and popcorn,
we are we're trying to make arrangements with a friend of ours in Denver who is a wholesale grocer, and he has agreed to help us get food out there, but in order to do it that way, it has to go with somebody. So one of the things we're thinking about is putting together a large supply of food and sending it with this guy, what's his, Mike Skipper?
Yes.
That's going as the
North
AA?
Northeast Ghana.
Yeah,
yes.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah.
Now, this is just an idea. I know that there are some groups, YWAM being one and another one, who have ships that they have purchased, and they use that in various ministries. And it may be with those group people to work out something in terms of shipping overseas.
Yeah. All right.
Was the atmosphere you described in Romania pretty typical of the Eastern European missionary works?
Well, it was not like that at all in Yugoslavia. Much looser, much freer. In fact, very little realization that you were in an Eastern European country. So it was quite a contrast. Those were the only two we were in. But from what the guys tell me, and our experience just at the Czech border, Czechoslovakia would be very much like Romania. Poland is apparently a little freer, because I was supposed to speak at a rally of 50 or 60 people in Poland the night that we were going to be there. You know, you could never do that in Romania. I don't know about East Germany. So it differs slightly from country to country. But from what I could gather, Romania, Czechoslovakia, probably East Germany would be three of the countries where we'd have to be the most careful. Yes?
When Craig was sick, was he in hospital?
Yes.
What are the hospitals like? Is it a good service?
Well, fortunately, we have on our team two doctors who are very good. And, of course, they take good care of our people because they have access to the right medicines. Medicines are always short. So he got good treatment. However, both Dave and Bruce told me that if there was ever, if they had, any of the family ever had to have surgery, if it were at all possible, they'd get him out of the country. Go to London, probably, because it's just about an 8-hour flight to London, nonstop. So there are certain things that they're pretty well taken care of, but if it's serious or if it's surgery, they'd probably try and get him out of the country. They were in the process of looking. They had to be out in about 2 weeks, and I don't know what has happened on that. Thank you.
Thank you, Jack.
Thank you.